From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
In a recent conversation with Doug Tallamy about ecologically minded fall cleanup, he raised the name of Heather Holm and how some of the pollinator research she's been part of lately is informing how he shifts his approach to garden maintenance this time of year and again in spring. I wanted to hear more, so Heather's here today to talk about how we can each support pollinators in our gardens beyond the season of bloom, in the off-season too. But first, these messages.
Programming and underwriting support from Brushwood Nursery. For more than 20 years, Brushwood Nursery has shipped the finest selection of clematis and other vines all over the United States with full-gallon-sized plant and free shipping. Their website is full of beautiful pictures and information on growing clematis. Brushwoodnursery.com. Programming and underwriting support from Garden Tool Company. Garden Tool Company's wide selection of heirloom quality tools for your gardening passion is backed by outstanding customer service, fast shipping, and ongoing support. GardenToolCompany.com.
Heather Holm is the award-winning author of the 2017 book Bees, and before that of Pollinators of Native Plants. Her expertise includes the interactions between native bees and native flora, and the bees' natural history and biology. I'm so glad she's here today to tune us into their needs. Hi, Heather, how are you?
Hi, Margaret. Thanks for inviting me.
Yes. So before we get started, I'll say that because I enjoy your books and use them so much, that we'll have a book giveaway. And actually, I want to give away a copy of each one of them. So with the transcript over on awaytogarden.com from this show, we'll do that. And then, as I said in the introduction, in that conversation about fall cleanup with Doug Tallamy, it dawned on me that as much as I know and as many experts as I've spoken to over the years about pollinator plants and pollinator gardens, I don't know as much at all about how a bee's life history really works and what's a bee's eye view of my place other than the flowers. And I wondered if you could kind of introduce us a little bit. I know there's many different species of native bees, but sort of generally speaking, clue us into how a bee sees a place like our gardens.
Sure. Yeah, as you said, the big take-home message is just bee diversity, right? So 3,700 species approximately in the U.S., and each has, basically each is overwintering in a different life stage than another. So it really makes it challenging in our gardens if we're trying to supply supplemental nesting sites, for example. I always get the question, well, when do the bees leave? and it always goes back to, well, it depends on the kind of bee. Mm-hmm. And the thing for people to remember is, you know, of those 3,700 species, about 90% have a solitary lifestyle. So they really have this narrow window of time during the growing season that they're active as adults. So we have, you know, bees that are the first bees to come out in the spring and are active for 4 weeks, maybe in April or May, depending on where you live. But then on the other hand, we have social bees, such as our native bumblebees, and they will be active throughout the growing season and have very different strategies for overwintering.
Mm-hmm.
So I can continue, but
yeah.
Bumblebees...
Well, Yeah, that's ahead. A good one. Bumblebees, I think, is a good group or whatever to kind of start with them and give us some examples of, you know, what are they looking for? What do they see as a good place, you know, et cetera? And again, beyond the flowers, right? I mean,
right. Long beyond the flowers. The flowers, particularly for bumblebees, the fall blooming plants are critical because what's happening in the fall is the new queens produced in a bumblebee colony are coming out and they're practicing foraging. And while they're visiting flowers to consume nectar, they're building up fat stores, which will help them for their winter hibernation. So most people are unaware that bumblebees are annual colonies. And unlike the European honeybee, which, you know, can survive the winter and the colony can be perennial, at the end of the growing season, no matter where you live, all the bumblebees will perish, except for those new queens that are preparing to hibernate. So they're hibernating as adults, and they go off and disperse from where they grew up in the nest, where their mothers raised them. And they're looking for a really nice insulated place to spend the winter. So that can be a number of different situations in a garden. It could be that they tuck themselves into a abandoned rodent hole. They may find a mouse nest. Often they're attracted to mouse nests. I live in the upper Midwest, so we have very cold winters. So they're really looking for, you know, an insulated place. But if you're further south, they may tuck themselves just under a heavy pile of leaf litter. Some hibernating queens people will find in their compost piles.
Right.
But the key is, you know, a place that's providing some insulation.
So when you said that the lifespan, this queen who's going to make the next generation, she came out, bees have, these native bees have a full metamorphosis, and there was an egg and a larvae. I mean, can you tell me, go back in her life a little bit? Or forward to her
Sure.
next generation? Yeah.
Yeah. So those new queens are called gynes, and they are produced at the end of the growing season. They overwinter as adults. And as you just said, they are the new queens of next year's colonies. So they're the queens, bumblebee queens live the longest of any of our native bees because they are alive for 12 or 13 months. So they're doing that initial winter hibernation as an adult, and then the following spring, depending on light and other phenological cues, they emerge from their hibernation site and then establish their own colony. But they will perish at the end of that growing season, but produce new queens. So it's a pretty precarious lifestyle, even though it's social, and you know, they have to survive the winter. They have to build up enough energy and fat stores to do so. They, you know, may be impacted by certain practices that we're doing in our garden. We, you know, we may be raking up a queen bumblebee tucked away for the winter and putting it in bags, leaf bags. So,
Yes. So
that's sort of the precarious part. And the other piece is having adequate food supplies, especially in early spring when they emerge. Because their energies are depleted, they need calories in order to start that nest initiation process.
Right, right. And in the early spring, I'll see them at the earliest blooming flowers, and I always in my head, in my very overly simplistic, almost not understanding at all, but all I knew was she's hungry, so to speak, but also she's going to provision a nest. So is that right? She's eating for herself and also collecting material to provision a nest. Is that
right? Right. Yeah. Correct. Yep. She's got to find an adequate supply of pollen producing plants because she's going to create a large pollen ball to where she'll lay her on multiple eggs. Mm-hmm. So plants such as willow and really early spring blooming plants are critical for bumblebees because they need that pollen supply. Nectar is their carbohydrate source, their fuel.
Right.
They do combine a little bit of nectar in with the pollen stores, but pollen's the critical piece for raising offspring.
Mm. And so if we were to pick another type of native bee to contrast against the bumblebee, which you said is the queen is the longest lived of our native bees, the queen bumblebee. There are some that are just that their adult life is what, a few weeks or?
Right. Yeah. So the 90% that have this solitary lifestyle, it's just a single female that's, you know, emerging from her nest where she was raised and living maybe 4 to 6 weeks. And she's doing all the nest construction and nest provisioning tasks herself. And so it's a very narrow window of time. And native bees, the males have a much shorter lifespan than females. They're basically their sole purpose in the bee life cycle is to mate with a female. Mm-hmm. But the females live a little bit longer because they're doing that nest provisioning. If we take that back to our gardens and maintenance, the ones that typically can be impacted by our maintenance practices are the 30% of native bees that nest above ground, and they would be, you know, building nests in cavities such as holes in wood, plant stems, supplemental nest that some folks will put out. So anything, if we're doing any clearing or cutting down or, you know, removal of materials such as that could be cavity nesting sites, then they would be directly impacted.
Okay, so if I want to do the best job I can, understanding that there's many kinds of bees with different needs, some are cavity nesters, some under some insulation on the ground or in the ground, like you mentioned, I think an old animal hole or something like that. Some nest in stems above the ground too, right? I mean, aren't there stem nesting bees as well?
Yes, yep. So stems can mean a number of different things. Some of our smaller cavity nesting bees, like pith-filled flower stalks, so plants in the aster family, for example, are ideal nesting sites for those smaller stem nesting bees. Similarly, some of our woody plants that are more softer wood, elderberry, sumac, they will have pith-filled centers or hollow centers. Ah. And the bees will mine out that styrofoam-like pith in the center and to excavate a nesting cavity. So it depends on the bee and where they preferentially nest, because you can imagine it nesting in an old flower stalk. The orientation of those stalks is near vertical, the way it's bloomed on top of those stalks. Whereas if they are nesting in a hole in a standing tree, those bees would preferentially like more horizontal nesting orientation. And then the other key thing is the size of the opening. So small bees will seek out very small diameter cavities, depending if it's in a hole in wood or a plant stem. And then the larger bees will be looking for larger cavities.
Huh. So here we are. It's fall cleanup. And this is why Doug mentioned, because we were talking about that, he mentioned your work. And you've been participating in some recent research, and you had some ahas that even he seemed, they seemed to even inform a different way of cleanup in the fall with something like the stem nesting bees and some of these others in mind. Can you tell us a little bit about that research and kind of what's the new news from it?
Sure. So for those stem nesters in particular, the ones that are in flower stalks, for many years I've been telling people, not to do any really fall maintenance or cleanup, and then in the spring to cut down the flower stalks and leave the flower stalk stubble. And that is what the bees would occupy for that nesting season. Going back to bee life cycles, we're talking about these solitary bees that nest in stems or cavities. Their egg to adult time frame is 12 months if they're producing one generation per year, which is typical. So if the confusion with gardening and maintenance and cleanup is if you leave the stem stubble as nesting opportunities, you have to leave it indefinitely. People will ask me, well, then when can I remove it? And so part of the messaging is we need to get beyond this cleanup mentality, right? I find in my garden, I let the leaf litter fall. I leave everything up for the winter. And in early spring, I cut back old flower stalks to provide new nesting opportunities. But I let all that plant debris just fall to the ground. And that the leaf litter combined with plant debris is really my weed barrier or my mulch alternative. So mm-hmm. It has a couple of advantages for bees. It's looser material. The bees that are ground nesting can easily crawl underneath it to excavate their nest below ground. And you don't have to purchase mulch. And mulch now is becoming a vector for things such as jumping worms. So I think people are thinking a little bit differently about using a lot of mulch in their gardens.
Right. Importing stuff, so to speak.
Right.
Right. A lot of gardeners are listening and they're thinking, okay, now wait a minute. What can I do that's still going to feel gardeny but is looser and so forth? And so, I and people who've listened regularly to the show know this, you know, I sort of started out as a million years ago as a sort of collector garden kind of person, you know, with all these, many of them non-native plants and, you know, more sort of designy kind of gardens and so forth of unusual things. And then I got tuned in maybe 20 something years ago to native things and birds and insects and so forth and more all the time. And so I still kept a couple beds around the house that are more that old designy stuff. And I've added looser areas farther out, so to speak, big areas that I practice more what you're talking about now. And, you know, sort of other ways when you talk to gardeners, how do you help them compromise or learn? Do you know what I mean? It's tricky.
It is tricky. I think you've got the perfect balance, right? If you have too much leaf litter for your more formalized or structured gardens, you can always transfer that to your more naturalized gardens.
Right.
And it really depends on the contrast between square footage of gardens and lawn and so on for each particular gardener. You know, my yard is 2/3 of an acre and my lawn is 30 feet by 15 feet. So it's very, very small. Uh-huh. So for me to move the leaves off the lawn and into the surrounding natural habitat isn't a big deal. But for some folks that have the opposite dynamic, mostly lawn and a little bit of garden, then yes, you would be inundated with the quantity of leaf litter and wondering, right, what do I do with all this and so on.
Right. Right. I haven't, you know, and really my solution, and that's definitely in quotes, has been more to identify areas which are getting larger all the time, by the way, that I am managing more loosely, and to, you know, tip the balance, reduce the lawn, obviously, areas around trees that were once mulch are no longer mulch. They're living mulch, you know, things like that to loosen up, right, in general, the way that things are maintained. So Sal, you were talking about, you know, solitary bees and social and so forth. The solitary bees, are those the ones that when people buy or make those bee houses, is that what they're, who they're trying to attract? What are those about? I'm, you know, with the little pieces of like bamboo or whatever, the hollow stem,
right,
kind of,
yep,
things.
Yeah. Those would be supplying supplemental nesting sites for the cavity nesting bees. The bee houses have become rather commercialized. So
yes,
I tend to not recommend people use them, partly because some of them are really poorly designed. They're very shallow. So you can imagine what's happening inside a cavity nest for a solitary bee is she's building multiple little rooms or cells, and each cell is partitioned with some kind of natural material. So they're lined up cell after cell after cell with a wall or partition in between. And so if you have a very shallow cavity, and shallow, but I mean by, you know, 2 to 3 inches is shallow, then she's only able to really have maybe 3 to 6 larval cells developing inside that cavity. Generally, there's bees have predators like most other natural organisms.
Yes.
So, you know, the first 3 or 4 larvae developing inside of that cavity could be predated upon by woodpeckers or parasitoids or you name it. So that's not a great situation if the design is poor, that you want to have longer cavities so that they can ensure that the ones at least at the back of the cavity will survive to adulthood. The other piece in why I don't encourage people to put these up is they do require maintenance and cleaning and replacement of stems. So many people have great intentions. It's much like putting up a nest box for birds.
Yes.
And, you know, probably only 10% or 15% of folks would actually do the regular cleaning out of the nest box and maintaining it and so on. So that's what I worry about with the supplemental bee nests. And that's one reason why I'm trying to encourage people to think, well, what are the natural ways that these above ground bees nest? Putting logs in your garden, if you're able to, if you live in suburbia or where somewhere that's appropriate, that's a great way to provide nesting habitat. Leaving a standing dead tree if you have a larger property, or having the tree removal company leave 10 feet of the trunk as a snag.
Yes.
That's great habitat for a number of things besides bees, birds, for example. So there, you just have to think a little bit about the natural ways. And the easy one that I mentioned earlier is the stem stubble. That's something any gardener can do. And that provides a nice array of nesting opportunities. And the difference between that and the supplemental bee hotels is the bee hotels are tightly aggregated nests, one next to the other. And that's not how these solitary bees nest. They nest in a cavity here, a cavity there. They're not, nesting right next to their another species. Or so what happens with the bee hotels is there's a higher propensity for disease transmission too.
Right.
So those are some reasons why I shy away from recommending them. Now, there are folks that do a really great job of maintenance and cleaning and stem replacement and so on, and that's great. They're also a very useful tool for teaching people about native bees at nature centers or something like that. But for the general homeowner that's busy and doing a ton of different things, I would shy away from putting them up.
So it reminds me so much of what you said, like the bird houses and so forth, you know, where people are like, well, I put up, you know, bluebird houses or whatever, but then it turns out it wasn't really, it was like a pretty cute house, fancy, designy, but it wasn't really designed with the species in mind and it wasn't maintained right and so on and so forth. So, yeah. So,
Yep, that's exactly it.
So in the last few minutes, I wanted to hear one thing, especially the stem stubble you've mentioned a couple of times. So, okay, so I'm not going to cut back in the fall. Okay, let's say I have like a meadowish planting or just even a bed of perennials. I'm not going to cut it back in the fall. And then comes spring and I'm going to do what? Like how high and what? Just describe it a little more specifically to me.
Yeah, so So you're out there in spring, you want to be careful not to tromp around in any of your gardens too early in the spring for all those other insects overwintering under the leaf litter.
Yes.
But if you have, what I do if I have a place to stand and cut the plant stems from, a sidewalk or a lawn, mm-hmm. You can start with those fairly early, cut down the old flower stalks, and the length that you want to leave is anywhere between 8 and 20 inches. So the research has found that bees will nest in a variety of cavity lengths. I generally I'm using garden scissors, so I chop and yes. Just try and eyeball at least more than 12, usually 15 inches of stubble.
Okay.
Yeah. And you don't have to do it for all plants, but this is a great opportunity for a gardener to, well, take a look at the stem. Is it hollow? Is it sturdy? I mentioned earlier plants in the aster family, they tend to have very, goldenrods, asters, black-eyed Susan, coneflowers, and so on. They tend to have very fibrous, sturdy stems that will last for another 12 months as a nesting cavity. Something like a daylily is too soft and wouldn't be appropriate. So concentrate on what you think are more fibrous and sturdy stalks. Take a look if the stalks are hollow or have a pith-filled center. Both are fine. Native bees aren't that big, even those larger ones I mentioned earlier that may nest in larger diameters. You don't want to leave any hollow stems bigger than, no bigger than a half inch diameter. So
okay. The
mason bees and leafcutter bees like 3/8 of an inch diameter. So
okay. If
we go to those really big tall plants such as Joe Pye weed that
yes. Have
hollow stems, you don't want to leave the, if the stem's edging on to 3/4 of an inch in diameter, that's not going to help native bees.
Okay.
Discerning by looking while you're cutting what would be an experiment.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Heather, there's a million more lessons that I need to learn, but your books, both of them, which we're going to have, as I said, the giveaway with the transcript of the show, of both books, are so helpful, such great guides. And I appreciate your taking the time today to talk, and I hope we'll talk again soon. Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Margaret.
Programming and underwriting support from Garden Tool Company. Garden Tool Company's wide selection of heirloom quality tools for your gardening passion is backed by outstanding customer service, fast shipping, and ongoing support. GardenToolCompany.com. Programming and underwriting support from Brushwood Nursery. For more than 20 years, Brushwood Nursery has shipped the finest selection of clematis and other vines all over the United States with full gallon-sized plant and free shipping. Their website is full of beautiful pictures and information on growing clematis. BrushwoodNursery.com.
And thanks to all of you for listening to Now Don't Miss an Episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or iTunes or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com. or on Facebook and Instagram as @AwayToGarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.